Hello, the podcasted two. This is Bob Garfield, and before we start listening to our show, I wanted to offer my sincere special wishes for the holiday season.
Bob, don't do this.
What? Senior producer Kathy Rogers.
I mean, if you're going to ask for money, seriously, do not wrap it up in Christmas sentiment. It's beneath you.
You think so little of me, Kat. You believe I'd play the Christmas card to get donations?
Yes, Bob. Yes, I do. I know exactly what you're up to, and I just want it to stop. I mean, just ask. Seriously, just ask.
Silent night, holy night, all is calm.
Okay, I am commandeering this pitch. Listen, guys, when you give to On the Media by December 31st, you do three things at the same time. First of all, you support this podcast, and you enrich the community by strengthening public radio for all listeners, and you get a tax deduction. So don't forget, your gift today will help pay for another year of On the Media in 2014. Please visit onthemedia.org to make your tax-deductible gift now. Or text OTM to 25383 and a $10 donation will appear on your next phone bill.
Sleep in heavenly peace.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. For years, the National Security Agency was so secret, the government did not acknowledge its existence. Now, in the wake of the Edward Snowden leaks and the revelation that the NSA reportedly tracks every phone call made in the United States and keeps the caller and recipient information for 5 years, the NSA is on a PR campaign, trying to persuade nervous citizens that, by golly, it's just so darn misunderstood. The charm offensive began last Sunday on CBS's 60 Minutes, whose correspondent John Miller visited NSA headquarters at Maryland's Fort Meade for an unprecedented one-on-one with eavesdropper-in-chief General Keith Alexander.
General Alexander agreed to talk to us because he believes the NSA has not told its story well.
We need to help the American people understand what we're doing and why we're doing it. And to put it simply, we're doing two things. We're defending this country from future terrorist attacks, and we're defending our civil liberties and privacy.
The next day, a federal judge would rule rather the opposite, that the vast vacuuming of telephone metadata is a violation of the Fourth Amendment. More on that coming up. But like most of Alexander's claims, some of which have been shown in the past to be misleading or just not true, it went unchallenged. Instead, Miller marveled at just how dedicated and whip-smart are the NSA's young analysts, such as with, I swear, a Rubik's Cube.
How long would it take you to do this?
About a minute.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Go. Many of the cryptologists skipped grades in school, earned master's degrees and PhDs, and look more like they belong on a college campus than at the NSA.
Yes.
Well, actually, the Rubik's Cube took him 1 minute and 35 seconds.
Miller, who has been in and out of network news between stints flacking for the LAPD, the NYPD, and the FBI, as recently as 2 years ago was himself working for the National Intelligence Directorate. And although he disclosed that, his reporting was dismissed as a love letter, and as the latest evidence of journalistic decline at the once vaunted 60 Minutes.
But the NSA didn't open its doors only to 60 Minutes. With reports of terrible morale and plummeting recruitment since the Snowden leaks, the agency is aware that it has an image problem. Which is how, last week, Daniel Dresner, professor of international politics at Tufts and a contributing editor to Foreign Policy, ended up spending a day at the agency talking to officials. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You spent a day with various NSA officials asking them questions on background, of course. Mm-hmm. Was there a united front?
I would say there were some responses where they were clearly unanimous. The rather candid admission that the Snowden affair had really hurt them and had hurt morale. And it was in some ways very surprising how candid they were. The other thing that they were generally in consensus on was that they saw themselves as a very heavily regulated agency. They kept stressing the idea that they're the only agency with oversight from all three branches of government, and that their compliance requirements force them to report what they would consider picayune infractions and mistakes.
Even if you credit that maybe some things that are counted as infractions shouldn't be counted as infractions, what gets the American public exercise is the general description of the program, mm-hmm. which was
scary
and misrepresented mightily in well-documented ways by General Alexander on 60 Minutes. So how can they improve their public relations if their top officials continue to either misdirect or outright lie?
In some ways, this is going to be a case where practice makes perfect. And they were very, again, upfront about this and saying, we recognize we need to do more, you know, communicating with the public. And we also recognize we're really, really bad at it. So in some ways, the only way they're going to get better is when they make these kinds of mistakes, then realize that the press is going to call them on it. Some of the NSA officials were more forthcoming than others about the sort of need to deal with the sort of changed climate, as it were. And others seemed to have a worldview that was frozen in amber in 2002, where they simply thought that all they had to do was say, it's a dangerous world out there, it's getting more dangerous, leave us alone and let us do our job.
You also suggested in the piece that the higher you went up the NSA food chain that day when you were doing all those interviews, the more walled off the officials were and the more tone deaf their remarks.
Yes, I would say that was a safe statement. The officials who had been there the least amount of time were clearly the ones most sensitive to what had happened in the public. And I would argue they were also the NSA's most effective advocates in trying to explain their position contra Snowden and contra other press leaks. On the other hand, the higher up you went up, I think these people have spent far more time at the NSA and far less time engaging in the rest of the world. So they would make statements that would cause you to shudder every once in a while, like one official in particular joking about wanting to make some reforms to the First Amendment. I think this person was joking. I'm honestly not sure. Either way, it really was not funny.
Right. And you said in particular the agency's attitude towards the press
yeah.
was not funny.
No. A lot of the complaints were the fact that they thought the reporting of this program or that program was stripped of context. Now, anyone who's ever interviewed any government official knows that this is sort of a standard complaint by most government officials. On the other hand, again, further up on the food chain, it was surprising how many complaints there were of the press, according to them, willfully misrepresenting programs, which is a more serious accusation. It's not to say the reporting has been flawless. They're in a situation where they're often reporting on programs that they don't completely understand.
Right.
So one understands why the NSA might be aggrieved. But the idea that they're willfully misrepresenting these kinds of reports seems to me a ludicrous charge. The problem is the NSA is deeply reluctant to talk about exactly what it's doing. And the other issue, I think, is that there's a philosophical disagreement over what exactly constitutes a privacy violation. In the NSA's perspective, the metadata collection, which they talk about, doesn't really constitute a privacy violation. We're operating in a technological world where, in fact, even the metadata constitutes a remarkably large footprint or signature on what people do. And that's in some ways the way in which the world has changed in a way that the law has not.
I think the issue is that we shouldn't be having this debate with the NSA to begin with. It really is the government with whom we should be having this conversation, the White House, the courts, the Congress, everyone but the NSA.
The issue is there are two ways you can frame this. The first way is to say this is a question about intelligence and what's the best way to protect the threats ostensibly against the United States. And I think that's the way the NSA would like it framed, because that means you rely on the NSA as an expert to give you an answer. The second and clearly way that it's evolving is the values trade-off of to what extent do you have to protect national security at the expense of civil liberties. There, I agree. That debate happens above the NSA's pay grade. And in some ways, the NSA's greatest defense about what it did was this notion of, trust us, we are not going to interfere with your privacy, and we're really good at what we do. And you can argue that the last 10 years of the way the U.S. has conducted homeland security has essentially eroded that trust.
I think the NSA needs an HBO series.
Or you could just add NSA to the Game of Thrones. That would be interesting, too.
Daniel, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel Dresner is professor of international politics at Tufts and a contributing editor to Foreign Policy. He wrote about his trip to Fort Meade in Foreign Policy.
On Monday, D.C. Federal District Judge Richard Leon issued a surprise injunction with, it was reported, wide implications for NSA surveillance. He described the agency's massive metadata gathering as, quote, an almost Orwellian exercise of unreasonable search and seizure, writing, quote, surely such a program infringes on that degree of privacy that the founders enshrined in the Fourth Amendment. Leon ordered the NSA to stop collecting the data on two plaintiffs and to destroy their records, although he stayed the injunction pending the inevitable appeal. Aziz Huq is a professor of law at the University of Chicago who studies constitutional law and national security. He says that the prospects for Leon's decision surviving the appeals process are remote.
Judge Leon's opinion will be appealed to a very conservative court of appeals, the D.C. Circuit. And then even if it were to survive in the D.C. Circuit, would go up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court's been very cautious with respect to surveillance issues.
Apart from the vulnerability of the decision in the appeals process, you believe that Judge Leon could end up affecting the law, but through an entirely different route, legislative. Senator Dianne Feinstein has a bill in play which is deemed quite hawkish on intelligence and security. Is it your guess that this decision will make it harder to pass such legislation?
Judge Leon's decision, if it were taken seriously, suggests that at least parts of the Feinstein proposal are unconstitutional, that there's a need for much closer judicial scrutiny of the government's both collection and use of telephonic or, by extension, internet metadata. And if members of Congress and their staff read and take seriously Judge Leon's decision, as I think that they should, I think that they would have to reject the Feinstein proposal in favor of some of the less hawkish proposals that people like Senator Wyden have put on the table.
Now, you've also imagined a scenario, have you not, in which Judge Leon's decision actually boomerangs in Congress and lends support to the giving NSA more leeway in its intelligence gathering and application of the metadata. How does that play out?
Imagine a scenario in which Judge Leon's decision is rapidly reversed by the D.C. Circuit, which is quite a conservative court. With that reversal in hand, someone like a Senator Feinstein or somebody else in the Senate or the House could well say, look, any kind of privacy concerns that people have identified here are really overblown. That might lead to the enactment of a new set of regulations which basically legalizes much of what many people see as troubling in the NSA's program.
There is a historical reason that you think that this could boomerang around in the way that you described. What is that?
The last time there was a major revelation about government surveillance, which was the revelation of the terrorism surveillance program by the New York Times, the legislative reaction to that was to retroactively immunize the telecommunications providers for their illegal participation and to enact a law that supposedly restrained the National Security Agency, that in fact granted it new powers that it had not had but prior to 2007. So rather than say, oh no, we need to rein in the agencies, what Congress did is say, oh no, we need to give these people more slack.
Now there's one scenario we haven't discussed, but I want to run it past you. The plaintiff in this case was a guy named Larry Klayman, who is, I guess the kindest way of saying it is he's quite a conservative gadfly and very litigious and does some pretty zany things through the courts. Do you think there's a chance that you're wrong and that Judge Leon's decision will be upheld all the way to the Supreme Court and someday people like you will be teaching students about Klayman?
It's a problem of small numbers. The federal judiciary is composed of a very small number of people. Whenever a new issue comes up, one can try and guess what those people's views will be based upon what they've done in the past.
that kind of prediction, which is a prediction about what somebody who you don't know very well is going to do on something entirely new, is really tough. And actually, Judge Leon's a really good example of that. Judge Leon is a Bush appointee. He's a quite conservative judge. He, on many other national security issues, such as Guantanamo, has taken a relatively hard line. This is not the kind of opinion that you would have expected him to reach.
Aziz, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
Aziz Huq is a law professor at the University of Chicago and has litigated civil liberties claims before the government.
All that was just what happened on Monday. Coming up after the break, NSA Week continues.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from Next Issue, providing unlimited access to popular magazines like The New Yorker, Rolling Stone, Time, People, Wired, New York Magazine, Vanity Fair, and over 100 more, all for a single price. Listeners can read as much as they want, all in one convenient app, and can try 1 month free at nextissue.com/media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On Wednesday, the NSA got a report card. The Intelligence and Communications Technologies Review Group released its 300-page report a month early. White House spokesman Jay Carney explained the decision in a briefing.
While we had intended to release the review group's full report in January, as I said earlier, given inaccurate and incomplete reports in the press about the report's content, we felt it was important to allow people to see the full report to draw their own conclusions.
Richard Clark is a member of that review group, a cybersecurity expert who has advised three presidents. He says that Carney's concerns were well-founded.
Well, let's see. The New York Times on the front page had a subhead to the effect that the review group was going to recommend the NSA program continue, and our recommendation used the word terminate.
Slate noted how strongly one of the panel's proposed changes echoed the decision of Judge Richard Leon earlier this week that the NSA's collection of telephony metadata was probably unconstitutional.
Well, we worked without any knowledge of what was going on in that court. It's not up to us to say things are constitutional or not. We certainly came to the same conclusion as the judge did in terms of the need for a court order before you access this kind of information. The government initially told us, oh, that would be too hard. We looked into it and we concluded it wouldn't be hard at all.
Why wouldn't it be hard?
The FISA court has been set up to be extremely responsive in emergency situations where you can go in and say, look, the Boston bombing just occurred. We need these pieces of information from AT&T, Verizon, Sprint, whoever. And you can usually get a warrant for that information within a few hours if you have to. And there's a provision in the law that says you can get the warrant after the fact in an emergency. We didn't see any high burden being placed on law enforcement to have to get a warrant.
But isn't one of the criticisms that the FISA court has been almost a rubber stamp and basically stepped away from doing any real adjudication?
Well, I know that's a popular belief. We actually got access to the FISA court's classified opinions. And the truth is, the FISA court has been giving NSA a hard time. They actually do a very good job of supervision. We would like to see the FISA court more diverse in its membership. Right now, 11 of the 12 judges come from one party. And we'd like to see the FISA court have a professional staff to help it, including a public advocate.
So you're saying it's wrong to assume that the FISA court has been allowing widespread access to this data? I thought that there were very few cases in which those requests were denied.
There have been very few cases in which they've been denied. There have been many cases in which they held up requests, sent them back, had them redone. There have been several cases where the FISA court restricted future operations because NSA had done things in ways that the FISA court wasn't happy with. We'd like to see the FISA court more aggressive, but the fact is, behind the veil of secrecy, they have been doing a pretty good job.
You also wrote that there's very little evidence to show that this kind of metadata collection is actually effective. You must have a pretty high clearance because most of us have no way of knowing whether this approach is effective or not.
Well, there are two different points. One is, effective or not, should it be done with a court order, and should the government hold the data in its own files? Second consideration is, has it really done us all that good? And with regard to the metadata on the telephony, we did have very high clearances. We did see all the data. We went through it case by case. We came to the conclusion that it was not necessary in any case where it was used. There was never a case where it stopped a terrorist attack.
The report also addresses the issue of national security letters, which are basically subpoenas with gag orders attached. We've talked about this quite a lot. You've suggested some changes in that area.
Pretty radical changes, according to some people. What we've suggested is, again, that you should go to the FISA court and get a court order. Now, I know that would be difficult because there are 20,000 of these orders every year. But all that means, in our view, is that you need more judges. The way it works today is an FBI supervisor can sign off on a national security letter, and without any outside review, they get the power of subpoena and the power then to gag the person that they've subpoenaed. So if they come to you at NPR and say, we want all your records, you can't tell anybody that. We found both of those parts of the national security letter a little difficult to square with constitutionality. We think they should probably go to the FISA court, and the assumption should be that there is no gag order. We know there'll be some cases with foreign counterintelligence operations where you'll never be able to tell people about it, but they shouldn't all have a perpetual gag order.
What surprised you most about the reactions to your report, both on Capitol Hill and in the media?
We got two kinds of reactions. The review group recommends everything staying the same, and the review group surprised everyone by being very radical in its recommendations. There was one blog that was entitled Awkward, that this report is going to be really awkward for the president. Actually, you know, I read that after meeting with the president. The president was very pleased by the report. But I understand why people think it's awkward for the president, because we're recommending some things that he has in the past rejected. But I think we're hopeful that we've made a persuasive case.
After spending so many years in government, you really think that there'll be a change?
I do. Look, government is not implacable. And when you have a leader like Barack Obama who is open-minded and who has the guts to bring in a group of outsiders like us and say, tell me what you think we should do and don't hold back, I think change is possible.
Also, there is bipartisan support for doing something about this.
There's a lot of bipartisan support, and that's utterly amazing because there's not bipartisan support for anything else right now.
Richard, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure.
Richard Clark is a member of the Intelligence and Communications Technologies Review Group.
What makes you more nervous, the government spying on you or private companies? At a hearing this week of the Senate Commerce Committee, Senator Jay Rockefeller weighed in.
I've served on the Intelligence Committee since before 9/11, and I can declare to you absolutely without a single thought that the protection that NSA provides to security and secrecy is far better than what we're going to be talking about today.
They were talking about the consumer data industry, brokering data on everything from your age to your preferred brand of soft drink. Even the segmentation of consumers into cohorts of demographic and financial similarity struck Rockefeller as perverse.
They sort economically vulnerable customers into groups with names like rural and barely making it. Not making it up, that's one of their categories. Tough start, young single parents. Rough retirement, small town and rural.
Kate Kaye covers the data industry for Advertising Age, and she joins me now. Kate, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks, Bob.
We live in a world of big data, and data which is obtained by brokers like Experian and Axiom routinely but through different means, most of which we surrender ourselves through what, terms of service agreements and the like?
And even just transactions that might happen through our credit card companies, they might provide aggregated information, or a grocery store loyalty program might pass on very high-level information about types of products that people in a certain region buy. And then it might be really traditional approaches to data brokerage come from the catalog industry. If you subscribe to J.Crew or Crate and Barrel, or they just automatically are sending you a copy of their stuff, all those catalog companies pool all of their data into a, what they call a data co-op, and they agree to give a bunch of information, so then they get a bunch of information from the whole pool of the catalog industry. That's how a lot of these industries work.
A lot of the data sold is anonymized, so that Procter & Gamble doesn't really know about Kate Kay
right.
and what you're doing. You're just a data point for them.
Yes.
But that said, some of this stuff is just mega creepy. Give
Absolutely.
Me some examples of the kinds of things that gave Senator Jay Rockefeller the heebie-jeebies.
The sale of lists of rape victims. I don't even know where that data comes from, but maybe law firms want to buy it. The idea of using really specific health data to target us. So if you're perceived as a diabetic, or maybe you've reached out to a company that says it can help you with your mother who has dementia, and then you end up in a list somewhere. In a lot of ways, with those things, you are actually telling the company you want more information. But the reality is most consumers don't really realize where that information is going to go, and they think they're just giving it to this one company that's going to help them. They don't realize it's going to be put into a list, and they're going to be sold and resold and resold for countless other purposes.
Big data is not used only to target apparent diabetics with diabetes products. Rockefeller seemed particularly freaked out by what I think they call dynamic pricing, the process by which, let's just say, Amazon might charge a different price for the same product to different people based on any number of factors, how many times they visited the catalog item, where they're located geographically, what other things they've bought online, and so forth.
Yeah.
Is there any aspect of big data that doesn't freak him out?
You know, something tells me that if he were running for re-election, which he's not, that his campaign would be using some sophisticated data analysis, and they would probably be buying lists that would have potential donors who would be interested in giving him money and voting for him and volunteering for him. This stuff was praised during the 2012 election as the most sophisticated, amazing approach to political campaigning ever. Obama's people were like touted as like the most brilliant people ever. And now we're looking at the consumer marketing industry doing the same thing that politics has done. Political people learned half of it from the marketing industry. And it's being demonized. I'm not saying either one is good or bad, but there's a really interesting dichotomy.
Well, you do raise an interesting point, and that is that Rockefeller was essentially shaking his fist at the industry and saying, well, okay, you've stymied me now, but I'm going to be back, and I'm going to make your life a living hell. But he isn't, because he is a lame duck. His term of office expires at the year's end.
Right.
Is there anyone else in the Senate who seems ready to pick up where Rockefeller left off?
There are definitely people who are interested in doing it. It's just a matter of, like, when's the right time? The biggest problem with trying to legislate this stuff is the rapid pace of technology. And we're looking at data coming from not just our digital media consumption, but, I mean, our phones. The fact that the NSA scandal still is interesting to people and is raising awareness of privacy issues, I think gives potential for some momentum behind comprehensive privacy legislation, but I don't know about next year.
In the end, what is more of a threat to us as citizens? Is it the gathering security state that has all sorts of metadata about our every electronic connection, or Unilever knowing about our hair care behavior?
Certainly, if you fear a police state, you'd probably answer the NSA. I think one thing that's interesting, and one of the things why this has come to a head and why hearings like this have happened, is because there's so much data now being collected. I can't tell you how many companies I've talked to who basically say, well, we're collecting all this information. We're not quite sure what we're going to do with it yet, but that's really disheartening to think about. But hey, the NSA is saying the same thing, aren't they?
They are indeed. Kate, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kate Kay reports on the data industry for Advertising Age. In October 2012, AOL CEO Tim Armstrong was on stage in New York trying to persuade a skeptical interviewer, me, that AOL's network of hyperlocal news sites, Patch, would be profitable by now. The secret, he said, was the combination of intense interest in neighborhood goings-on and vibrant local economies, multiplied by nearly 1,000 communities.
If I told you your first day on planet Earth, local is probably a top five item in people's lives, and I gave you all the statistics about how big those commercial areas are, do you think over time that you could have a business that does $200,000 per town in revenue? I think over a period of time, the answer is, you know, yes.
Well, now Patch may be on the verge of being shut down, raising the question of whether a staff of one or two can sustain itself by covering neighborhood news. Buzz Machine blogger and professor Jeff Jarvis says not to worry. Hyperlocal has a case of the cooties, but no fatal disorder. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Hey, Bob.
Cooties? What do you mean by cooties?
Like, ew, I don't want to touch that. I don't want any of that on me. And that's the problem when something like Patch gets in trouble. People are going to say, yeah, see, hyperlocal never worked. But they're wrong. Hyperlocal's not dead. Patch didn't kill it.
Okay, now, AOL cherry-picked its communities. And as Tim Armstrong said in the opening cut of tape, it cherry-picked them based on affluence, the advertising market conditions, and so on. And their costs were rock bottom. But in town after town, they just could not make the nut. Does that not frighten you?
No, because I think that Patch was really an old media company in its thinking, right? We're going to control this vertical. They vowed they would kill bloggers in town. We are going to sell advertising the way it's always been sold, space on a website. And I think that instead, the way that hyperlocal is going to grow is that it's going to scale from the bottom up. Hyperlocal is about ma and pa operations in people who care about their towns, who want to contribute to their town, who want to bring things together. I'm doing a lot of work on the ecosystem in New Jersey, where we have 30, 40, 50 local blogs and various sites. And they're there for different reasons. They're different kinds of blogs. Some are video, some are for-profit, some are not-for-profit. And working with CUNY and Montclair State and WNYC and the Dodge Foundation, we've put together a support structure for these independent beings to be able to succeed better. A content sharing network, an audience sharing network. Soon, by God, I'm going to create an advertising sharing network, training for them, and other kinds of support. So that's how scale comes. You take these independent beasts and you put them together in a way that matters, rather than the Patch way, which was to say that we're going to control 1,000 towns like that overnight. That's not possible.
I want to ask you a question that has something to do with, I don't know, the laws of economics and something to do with the laws of physics. Can hyperlocals, considering the amount of money that you have to make just to keep the lights on, can they generate enough revenue without being staffed by essentially monks working for virtually nothing in order to do public service?
You have to be willing to eat ramen noodles a lot, yes, like any startup. It's hard work. But, you know, what I've learned, Bob, is that a beat can be a business. It no longer has to exist inside a bigger organization, and a beat can be self-sustaining, whether that's covering a town or a demographic or the FCC, for that matter. It's a tough business, but it's possible. We know this. 3 years ago at CUNY, we did research on the business modeling of the hyperlocal ecosystem, and we found local bloggers scattered around the country who were bringing in upwards of $250,000 a year. Hard work, scraping every dollar. This is Hamburger Hill you're going after, man. And it is possible to support them, but they need help. They need support. They need to be members of bigger networks. Now we're at the point where we're going to find scale in hyperlocal by enabling this.
All right, fair enough. But it seems like altogether, what you're describing is more than just a case of cooties. You're describing a very fragile organism, a vulnerable newborn. How sanguine are you about the chances of that child growing and thriving?
I dare not predict, Bob, but I do see the means for this child to grow and survive. We're in the very beginnings here. What we're seeing is the replacement of a media industry controlled by vertically oriented companies that owned everything from idea to delivery. And it's now being replaced by an ecosystem of many independent players who operate under their own business models and means, and who are each of them fragile, but who together can have a lot more strength and a lot more power than the old vertically integrated monopolies had. It's going to take time and effort to get there, and it's not going to happen on its own. I think that Patch executed badly in that it didn't get its model down before it multiplied its mistakes times 900. But in a sense, that's quibbling. Armstrong is still right. We in local communities, especially in America where we have local government, we need local information. I believe there's a market demand for it. And so people like me in universities, you in public media stations, we can do a lot. We who have resources and have some measure of power have to bring it to bear to help the little sprouts grow out of a fertilized field.
Well, we've exhausted our allotted metaphors in this conversation. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you.
City University of New York professor Jeff Jarvis blogs about media at buzzmachine.com.
In Batavia, a small town in upstate New York, and neighboring towns in Genesee County, residents turn to their hyper-local news source named, naturally, the Batavian, to learn lots of the latest local news. Yes, the Batavian is both filling a need and paying its bills. For the last 5 years, publisher Howard Owens has been at the helm of the Batavian, which he runs with his wife, Billy, and some local stringers.
One of my advertisers was in the Verizon store across the street from one of our fire halls. And she said the store was packed. It was holiday season. The doors to the fire hall open up. The trucks roll out. Sirens blaring. Lights going. And every person in that store was looking at their phone. And somebody goes, Howard hasn't updated the site yet. And she's like, geez, guys, give him a minute. You know, we've trained people to constantly check the site to find out what that latest news is.
We learned this week in the New York Times, David Carr's column, that although Tim Armstrong's Patch isn't dead, it's only barely breathing. Why do you think it hasn't succeeded?
When Patch started, it was a pretty good concept. One journalist, one editor in each community. I think it's very hard when you have just a wage-earning employee to get them to produce the kind of content consistently over a 24-hour period that a local owner will do.
It's a great motivator to actually run the publication, not just be paid by it, right?
Right. There's multiple layers of advantages to local ownership, from those relationships with the advertisers to that investment that you're going to get up at 2:30 in the morning to go cover a fatal accident because it's your business. It's not just a job.
One of the criticisms of the Patch experiment is that the content was pretty light.
And I always kind of cringed at that criticism because we do a lot of that too. We also do investigative pieces and in-depth features and sports coverage and hard-hitting meeting coverage, but you will find the most trivial stuff going on in Genesee County on the Batavian, and that's really an important part of the mix, that sense of we're giving them a broad picture of what's going on in their community.
Your coverage area right now is 57,000 people. And reportedly, you reach 40,000 of them per month. That's huge. What does reaching 40,000 mean? That 40,000 click in?
Webmetrics is very slippery. I mean, we definitely reach 50 to 60, maybe even 70% of the residents on a monthly basis here. On a daily basis, I've been able to figure out it's maybe about 18%, which still, in my experience, you know, I've done a lot of work with online newspapers. That's substantially higher than a typical daily newspaper website.
What are you doing that the local newspapers aren't doing?
We have a very strong comment community, and then the other thing is breaking news. Now, the local newspaper competitor does try to compete with us on breaking news, but the local newspaper model across the country is the editor's telling you here's what the top news is. So the fender bender on Main Street is never going to be at the top of the page.
I see.
Where, you know, we get people sitting in their office and they hear ambulances go down the street and they're refreshing the page to find out what's going on.
You also refer to something called cat crosses the street journalism.
You know, we had a reporter go out and somebody had written in chalk some song lyrics on the sidewalk. And he just took those pictures and posted them. A traditional journalist would go, no way is there any news value there. But we got a ton of interest in those posts. People leaving comments helps feed that interest and reinforce that brand that we're telling people what's going on right now.
You mentioned that you've done also investigative stories. You cover town meetings. These are things that people who watch where the media are trending these days are terribly worried about. But those take a lot of manpower. What kind of investigative work can you actually do?
Well, I know there have been one or two stories that I'm like, that's too big for me.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if you're motivated to get something and kind of keep your eye on the ball, you're able to get those kinds of projects done in between going out and covering the cat crossing the street.
Now, one discussion that we've been having in the office is whether hyperlocal news is being freighted with the challenge of trying to save journalism, rather than just being regarded as a success if it can support one or two people to fill in some of the gaps in the coverage that people want.
There's a tendency to believe that a chain or a news organization should spring forth in full flower. If you go back to 1835 and look at the penny press, these were papers that were not, by today's journalism standards, well-staffed or producing what we would call high-quality journalism. It's going to take the same sort of time for local online media to grow. And I'm not even necessarily predicting that we will have the same kind of success, but there is a tendency to judge local online media today by old-school standards.
So you believe in this?
Absolutely. I believe this can work. I believe it can work anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you just look at the site and see all the ads that we have, you see that that's true. The fact that we can do that tells me anybody can do this. You have to have the vision. You have to be willing to work.
And you can pay your bills?
Yes.
Howard, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Howard Owens is the publisher of The Batavian. Coming up, Reagan's welfare queen was not a myth, nor was she merely a welfare queen.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Back on the campaign trail in 1976, Ronald Reagan told a story about an unnamed woman whose crimes were almost too brazen to be believed.
To collect food stamps, Social Security, veterans' benefits for four non-existent deceased veterans' husbands, as well as welfare. Her tax-free cash income alone has been running $150,000 a year.
In October of the same year, her fraud had escalated.
She has used 127 names so far, posed as a mother of 14 children at one time, seven at another, and once while on welfare, posed as an open-heart surgeon, complete with office.
Josh Levine, executive editor at Slate, investigated the story of Linda Taylor, America's original welfare queen. Welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
So, take us back to the 80s, Reagan as president. He gave the press a ready-made symbol for the problem of welfare. Was Linda Taylor really the kind of criminal that he portrayed her as?
The welfare stuff was a pretty narrow slice of this woman's criminal career. She was investigated for homicide, kidnapping, baby trafficking. Reagan didn't mention any of those things.
The welfare queen, however, was not entirely Reagan's creation. The Chicago Tribune had a big hand in this. So could you discuss the role of the press in this story?
Sure. George Bliss was a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer for the Tribune, and he wrote a lot of stories about public aid problems in Illinois. You know, he would have headlines about state probing Medicaid problems. Good journalism, but not something that'll make you spit out your morning coffee. And then he found the welfare queen.
For most news outlets, the welfare queen seems to be where the story of Linda Taylor began and pretty much ended, because you suggested it wasn't in anyone's interest to tell the whole story.
By naming her the welfare queen, the Tribune could narrow its focus on this public aid crisis that they believed was happening. Ronald Reagan could make a point about a policy angle that he wanted to pursue and try to appeal to working class voters who would be very offended by this sort of theft. Reagan's opponents could say that Reagan was fibbing or that he was exaggerating her crimes. You know, and the police, politicians were in their ear saying, we've got to put a handle on this. And you know, her other crimes, the kidnappings, the, you know, alleged homicide, those were very difficult to investigate. And, you know, the political will was really pointing them towards focusing on getting her welfare stuff under control.
So is there a hero in your story?
If there is one, I think it's the Chicago police detective, Jack Sherwin. He runs across this woman. She files a false burglary report, kind of an insurance scam situation. He writes her up for that. The second time, different woman, different apartment, different part of town, similar situation, false burglary report. She was wearing a different wig the second time that he met her. She was kind of a master of disguise. The head of the Legislative Advisory Committee on Public Aid would say she's black, but she could also look Asian and, you know, Latino and white. And that was kind of the mystique around her, that she was such a shapeshifter.
What tipped off Sherwin that the person he'd seen a couple of years earlier filing a false report was the person he now suspected of filing a false report?
Well, the scam was so similar. She was claiming that her fur and jewelry and whatnot had been stolen. There was something that, like, caused a tingle. He asked her to go get a glass of water for him, and he ran the fingerprints off the glass. And that's how he discovered that it was the same person, and he started digging and found out that she maybe had seven different husbands, all these different names and addresses.
Sherwin feels that even though she was convicted, she ultimately beat the system.
Right. She was convicted of welfare fraud and perjury for lying to a grand jury about the different names that she used. She wasn't in prison for more than 4 or 5 years. And as far as I could tell, she didn't go to prison after that for possible murders. She was never convicted of any of the alleged kidnappings. Back in the 60s, a cop found that she had kids that didn't belong to her on a couple of different occasions, but the children were returned and no charges were ever filed.
Except for one child.
Right. In 1964, there was a child named Paul Joseph Fronczak who was taken from his mother's arms in a Chicago hospital by a woman dressed as a nurse. It was written about everywhere. There were hundreds of cops looking into this, 50 FBI agents, 35,000 people interviewed in connection to this case.
Do you have an appeal to the kidnapper?
I pray that she'll take care of the baby and return him.
Nobody was ever arrested. The child has never been found to this day, 50 years later.
Linda Taylor, as we're calling her, switched race and age when convenient. Could you say that there's a sort of parallel between her protean shape-shifting and the way her story reflected prevailing attitudes about race?
Here's an answer. It was around the 1960s that you started to see the phrase welfare mess appear in the press and out of the mouths of legislators. And that was when more African-Americans started being added to the welfare rolls. Benefits that had previously been denied were being granted to folks that were, in fact, eligible for them. Robert Byrd, the senator, held these very racially charged hearings about, you know, how the money was going to women and their paramours and, you know, being spent on alcohol. And images around this time of poverty and magazines went from usually depicting white folks to depicting black folks, far out of proportion to the numbers that were receiving welfare. And so fast forward to the 1970s when Ronald Reagan starts talking about this woman. She is written about in the press as a black woman. You know, Reagan never said this woman is black, but voters, I think, could infer that that's what he was talking about. And I think that's the image that has certainly persisted in people's minds when you hear the term welfare queen.
One of the many ironies in your story is that although Ronald Reagan dusted off the welfare queen's lurid misadventures, arguing, as you say, that rampant fraud demanded decisive government action, in fact, most of the savings he recouped wasn't in cutting fraud, but in cutting benefits. And so it continues, right?
Right. I think, you know, there's currently a debate going on about food stamps and cutting from that program. There's the idea that we can just cut out fraud and abuse, and that will save billions upon billions of dollars. But I think it's just really a myth.
You quote Eric Schnurer in The Atlantic saying that none of the savings in the current food stamp cuts would come from fraud, but purely from funding and tightening the benefits.
Right, but when you hear politicians try to sell it on the House floor to their constituents, you still hear the same kind of language about, isn't it so frustrating when you see someone in the grocery store with king crab legs and then they put it on the EBT card.
Mm-hmm.
It's just this idea that the people who are getting food stamps or the people who are getting any kind of other kind of public aid, they just don't deserve it. And so if we cut it, we're not cutting off anyone who might need this to feed their family. We're cutting off the king crab leg people.
Josh, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Josh Levine is executive editor at Slate, and his story in Slate is called The Welfare Queen.
People talk about me both night and day. I cried, Lord, please forgive them, and I know.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, KJ Vogt, Sara Durkman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, and Krista Ripple. We had more help from Kimmy Regler. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Andrew Dunn and Ken Feldman.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. If you're jonesing for more OTM during the week, you really should get into TLDR. You can find it at our website, onthemedia.org. It's a blog which is updated twice daily and also a weekly podcast. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.